Hello and welcome to the Osteopod. This episode is different. This is not your typical interview with students from med school talking about their school. I've gotten together with some of my classmates here at the last week, literally the last week of school. We graduate on Friday, and this is Tuesday. But we're here talking about our journeys to residency. I was inspired to do this episode when I listened to some podcasts from the undifferentiated medical student, where they talked about their fourth year journey to getting into residency. And I thought, let's approach this from a DO perspective and see if there's similarities and differences there. So that's what this episode's all about. I'm joined by two of my good friends and classmates going into different specialties at different locations. And so I thought a couple of different perspectives on how to get into a residency as a DO and what the process is like, and what the process is like in general for a med student to get a residency at the end of a fourth year. I think we'll cover some bases here. So once again, I've probably mentioned this on the podcast before, but I'm going into pathology here at the University of Utah. And I'm actually rotating here in Utah, so it's not a big move for me, maybe an hour north, but so the adventure is short. But let's go ahead and learn about some of the other people on the podcast here. Ladies first, Avery, if you want to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, where you're from, what specialty you're going into, and where, and we'll go from there. So
sounds good. Awesome. Well, my name's Avery. I am a classmate of Phil's. I matched into pediatrics at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines. I'm originally from Park City, Utah, and have been doing my rotations here in Utah for the most part as well. So I'm excited to move out to the Midwest in the next couple weeks here.
That's crazy. I feel like time has flown by so fast with, and of course, those listening to this years in advance, this is being recorded during the pandemic with COVID. And time definitely goes by pretty quick when you're on quarantine. So yeah, all of a sudden we'll be working in the hospitals. But thank you, Avery, for being on the show. And I'll turn it over to Bo. Let us know who you are.
Thanks for having me, Phil. So my name is Bo Condi. I'm from St. George, Utah. I'm matched into family medicine at Clarkson Family Medicine in Omaha, Nebraska. And yeah, I met these guys at school, great people. Also did most of my rotations in Southern Utah, so haven't really left home too far. Went to Colorado for school, but was able to come back for rotations. So that's been great.
Yeah. I feel like I've kept up with you guys mostly because you've been here in Utah and closer during rotations, but let's go ahead and get started with this podcast. At the end of third year, you know, we're finishing up our core rotations, maybe taking some elective time, studying for step two. If I remember right, and it's weird because I had these dates like so set in mind when it was happening, you know, getting ready for residency interviews and setting up audition rotations. But I forget, I believe it was about April, March or so of, you know, last year, when we could get audition rotations together for the beginning of fourth year. I feel like that's the first step in fourth year to getting a residency. Oftentimes for DOs as well as MDs, I'm sure, is to do an audition rotation. And so I'll turn it over to you guys at first. And let's open it up to what that process was like to setting up some of your audition rotations. I know, Bo, I know that you went to your residency site first, you know, last year and did an audition there too. Did you do that as well, Avery?
I did. It was my second sub. I was where I matched.
Cool. So whoever wants to go first, can you walk us through the process of what that was like setting up and getting all that, you know, audition rotation stuff ready to go by the time your fourth year started?
So I did it. I mean, we kind of got information from our school to set up the whole VSAS program, trying to set up those rotations. So I started kind of looking into that it's just another kind of system like ERAS or ERAS, however you want to pronounce it, just to kind of upload your application and kind of apply to these different auditions or sub-internships. And so I started looking at that, but the programs I was most interested in that I ended up auditioning at, they just had their own systems through their own websites. And so you'll have different means of going about these setting up auditions. It could be on an individual website or through these systems that are set up. But so with that, most of the stuff will be kind of standardized, I would say, between some stuff. They might ask for a personal statement, medical school transcript, just some information about you and board scores too, just to kind of see if you're going to fit within where they're looking at. But it was a really nice process. Mine was all through email, just communicating with the program directors, or not the program director, but the program coordinator. And felt like it was a really good process, had a good experience. And it comes up quick. So as soon as you're, you know, finished vegging after your boards and stuff, this is kind of something you got to hop on top and just kind of get things rolling so you're not super stressing at the end.
For sure. And I feel like the way that the application process went was one of two ways. It was either the standardized VSAS application where you do upload a bunch of documents, and usually the rotations start to open up for applications around March or April of your third year, or programs in specific will tell you to apply through email and whatever process they need you to follow, they will let you know. With you, Avery, was yours mainly VSAS, or was it also, or was it an email, or was it common? Because you did more than one audition rotation.
I did a pretty shotgun approach with mine. So I had about 40 programs that I was interested in that I thought would be a good fit. And so I found all of them on VSAS. If they weren't on VSAS, I sent an email to the program and said, and would look through their website and see if it said anything about audition rotations or doing away rotations there. And if it didn't say anything, I would email them and ask about it. The place where I matched blank ended up being an email, and it was super easy, just with the program coordinator. She just asked when I was available and we set something up. But everything else was VSAS, and I would say I was available for 6 months. And then when someone got back to me, I would then go through with all the other applications and just block out that month, unless it was a program I was more interested in than the other one. But I think a lot of people with whom I talked on the interview trail said that applying to VSAS was sort of a depressing thing because you get a lot of rejections, and it is not indicative of whether you're going to get into that program or whether or not they like you necessarily. I did a sub-I at a program that did not invite me to interview because they were not selective at all with their VSAS screening, but they were selective with their interview screening. And so I just sort of weaseled my way in there and got to learn from them for a month, but it was just a first come first serve thing with that one.
Sure. And that's interesting too. So contrasting that with my experience, I only did VSAS. I only went to one location. I did all three of my audition rotations at the U, which was beneficial and detrimental as well. Beneficial because I really got to understand different areas of pathology and really get to know the program, which I ultimately ended up matching to. But if, you know, there were other programs that I was interested in as well, and if I had done an audition there too, it might have helped my application too when it came to interview season. And so I'm ecstatic to go to the U. But the advice that I give to third years and upcoming students is that audition rotations are important to do. One, for your actual, you know, education and benefit, learning how to work at a higher level. And I'm going to ask you guys, because in pathology, it's different. It was very, very much observational. I didn't get to do a lot of hands-on work during my audition rotation. It was more of the theoretical, you know, ask me questions and what do I know about these certain things. But so I'm definitely interested in hearing about your guys' experiences during an audition rotation, sub internship. But looking back too, and it's interesting to hear that you, Avery, went to a place, but and if I understood this right, and this actually happened to some other of our classmates too, where they would go and do an audition rotation. And of course you and the people that I know are great, you know, physicians in training, but you didn't get an interview there. And so looking back, was it worth it? Was it worth going to these locations and doing an audition rotation there where, you know, you may or may not get an interview there?
Yeah. For me, I would say yes. I went somewhere that, so the place where I did my first rotation, I was in the PICU there, and I think that I was not invited to interview because my level one score wasn't high enough, and they were not selective with who got to come do auditions, but that set me up really well for the other three sub-I's that I did, two of which were also in the PICU. So by the time I got to those sub-I's, I knew how to present. I knew how to do a handoff really well. And just someone coming in with a common pathology, I could very easily take care of it on my own. And that was something that some second year residents had never spent time in a PICU before. So they were learning how to do that, whereas I had been doing it for the last 2 months. So I felt that was really important. Also, there were connections there between the place where I did that first rotation and then where I ended up matching. Mm-hmm. One of the preceptors who I think really pushed for me and helped me get in to my program, maybe, or at least was very encouraging of me ranking them highly, he had trained at the program and done his PICU fellowship where I had just been the month before. So we knew the same people, and just the way that he taught and presented, I knew his pimping questions because I already had them. Yeah. So I think it was very advantageous and nice to have one where you can kind of mess up and figure it out. And yeah. So it was a good trial run, a good practice run for me. So I would advise it.
Cool. How about you, Bo? What was your experience like during an audition rotation? And looking back, would you have done it the same? Would you have done it differently? Would you have gone to the same place or places? What was your experience like?
So my experience, I mean, yeah, my first audition rotation was with the program I ended up matching with, and that was just an awesome experience with them. The way they set it up in family medicine for the most part is sometimes you get 2 weeks of kind of inpatient medicine and another 2 weeks of clinical medicine. And so I had an opportunity to work with some residents in the hospital for 2 weeks, and they let you basically kind of take on the role of a sub intern where you're seeing patients on your own. And then you kind of get to present them to the attending, the rest of the group. And you just bear in mind that a resident's already seen these other patients too. They're seeing their own patients. You're not the sole provider of this person that you're seeing. So it's just a really good learning opportunity. And everyone I met there was just super helpful. They want to teach you. They're also just kind of gauging to see if they want to work with you too. And that's what you're doing with them too. And that's what I thought was really beneficial about these audition rotations is you're there for a month unusual. And so you kind of get a good view of what the program's like, who the people are like, and if you can really see yourself working there. And I could actually honestly tell myself after being at this program for a while, like, yeah, I could work here every day. You know, I would love to work with these people. I ended up doing 3 audition/sub-I rotations. And our school at first actually required 3 to be done, and then they lowered the requirement to 2. I feel like it just depends on the person. If it's something that you really like learning that environment, if it's something you're really trying to figure out these different programs and see it from the inside better, I honestly felt like I could have been good with 2. Not to say like one program was bad or I wouldn't have gone to that program, but I felt like I could have been good with 2 programs just based on I had to live away from home for a month at a time, just with my wife being back home. And it was kind of just harder as far as the living far away for a little bit. But I think as you research these programs and just want to get a better look at it, you can't go wrong with just trying to audition at these places.
For sure. So from what I understand from, you know, your guys' experiences and perhaps some other classmates' experiences as well, an audition rotation is a good thing to do if you want to learn more about your specialty, get more responsibility, be better prepared for, say, you know, you do an audition at some place and then you do an audition later at a place that you are more likely to rank higher, and you can kind of have that extended interview go a little bit better. So I think that's a good plan to have in mind. But it's also important to know, I guess, that an audition rotation doesn't necessarily mean you will get an interview, let alone get ranked highly on their end when it comes to interview season. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And so perhaps if you feel like that might be the case, then you might not need to go and do an audition rotation at that place. You might as well just interview and see what the place is like in one day. And so I think everyone's situation and specialty is different. You guys, you know, from family medicine and pediatrics is definitely different from my experience with pathology. And so I feel like, and this is, you know, talking to those who are listening, if you reach out to your upperclassmen and talk to them about where, you know, in their specialty, where they went for an audition rotation, why they went there, and if it was, you know, worth it to go out and do that, maybe that can help you gauge whether an audition rotation is right for you. But in general, it's a great experience to learn more about your specialty and really sink your teeth into it. Let's move on to the next part. So you've set up your audition rotations and you've had them usually between August, September, October. Is that when you guys did your audition rotations?
Yeah, I did one like towards the end of August, ending early September, and then another one, I think late October to November, mm-hmm. maybe mostly late October, and then another one in January. So I did one pretty late, but I think it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, and go ahead, Avery.
I did my first one in July. And then I took August off because my brother was getting married. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be there for that. And then end of August, I did three back to back and finished up beginning mid-November.
Cool. And that's the thing too. Like you can do audition rotations during the interview season, even up until, you know, January or so. Sometimes you can go to a program that you've visited and interviewed at already and do an audition rotation there. It really depends on, you know, where you go and what you see and what you want to do with your time. But you kind of do that process. And then you get to June and July of your end of third, beginning of fourth year. And that's when you do ERAS, whatever it stands for. I don't know. Some people say ARIS as well. Maybe if you're on the East Coast, that's that's how you say it.
Fancier than we are.
It's yeah. Pretty fancy, yeah. I'm all about that ERAS out here in Utah.
But, that's how I am too.
Yeah. So let's talk about the process of getting your ERAS application together. What was it like for you guys? We'll start with Bo. What was the process like for you finally, you know, getting your application together?
It's pretty kind of a surreal experience. Like you're finally at that point. But it helps with some preparation just before that all really starts. Because you'll get, I pulled up kind of a timeline for you. Mm-hmm. This is from the AAMC website. So you can go to this website too and just kind of look at the timeline of the match process. It'll give you all the pertinent dates, kind of give you a good overlook of what's going on. But I mean, it says ERAS for this cycle actually started June 6, 2019, as far as that's when you can register for the program. And then you can immediately start working on your application. So that's what's really helpful. So that doesn't mean you have to start thinking about everything right then. You can start thinking of things before that. And so that's what I kind of did with our school prepped us a little bit with starting our CV, getting all those pertinent information down. You got to think about your volunteer opportunities, your scholastic awards, as well as just work and research and hobbies. And so it kind of helps if you can kind of prep those things before the ERAS actually opens up, because you can immediately start putting it in. But you don't have to worry too much, just because you don't have to really kind of have everything ready until September 5th through the 15th. So I felt like I took it kind of as a day-to-day approach. I didn't really stress myself out too much on certain times. I would just try to do a little bit each day. Or if you have a free weekend, try to do more as you can. But it, just in my experience, it helps to kind of get some of those ideas jotted down early. Because if you leave it all towards the end, of just kind of right before everything kind of is submitted, you're going to have a really bad time. I'm not sure what Avery's experience was as far as what she did, but.
Yeah, I honestly don't really remember being stressed out over ERAS. I remember actually hitting submit was stressful, yeah. And you're kind of, okay, here's my fate. I'm throwing it into the wind.
Right.
But as far as preparing for it, I had been asking for letters of recommendation from preceptors with whom I clicked really well throughout third year. And for most of those, they agreed to write one, but said, wait until it's a little bit later on. So a few months before ERAS, or even in the spring, I think I was starting to reach out to preceptors and say, hey, I hope you're doing well. Loved your rotation, sort of butter them up, and then ask, just kind of remind them. So remember we talked about this and that this thing is going to be due. And I gave them 1 or 2 months heads up before it was due. And I kind of created my own personal, I think it was 3 weeks ahead of the time that it actually was due, that I said that I needed it by then. Mm-hmm. So that then that still gave me 3 weeks to annoy them if they didn't get to it. And it was not going to stress me out. So letters of recommendation were kind of in the pipeline. CV, that was something that was also done before that started. And I remember thinking about my personal statement for a long time and having multiple people look at it. I think the most important person that I had look at it is in marketing. And she was really big on, you're selling yourself on this and you need to do a good job. And it needs to be something that is easy to read and enjoyable and is really who you are. But I think that was something I wish I had known or taken into account before putting it all together, is that all of those things, your letters of recommendation, which you don't have control over, but ideally would sort of all be putting, you're branding yourself as far as who is the person that they're going for. So if it's something you don't want to talk about on interviews, don't put it in your CV and definitely don't put it in your personal statement.
For sure. Really good pieces of advice from both of you guys, right along the lines of what I was thinking about telling someone who had questions about the whole ERAS process. Getting your CV and all of your documents in on time, starting in third year, you know, with your CV, you take small steps, like you said, Bo, and get that ready. Because I think the first piece of advice that I'd give someone would be to submit your application when it's due, because you can submit it later on. I think you can submit ERAS until like December or something, you know, and submit it for interviews that late. But I think you have a better shot, and I could be wrong about this, you know, how programs look at and filter out programs or applications. But the earlier you get it in, say the first couple of days within the first, you know, week that it's open, that the whole ERAS application is open to submit, if you can have it ready by then, that's great. You know, you've set yourself up for the most success during interviews. And I love what you guys are saying about letters of recommendation and personal statements. So let's get into a little bit of the details with those as well. For example, the advice that I give people in pathology would be to, of course, rotate with pathologists and try to get letters of recommendation from pathologists, the people in our specialty, both in the community. Let's say you shadow and rotate with some pathologists out in a regular clinic or a community hospital versus those at an academic center, especially those places where you might audition, and getting letters from them is super important. And having both a community and an academic letter on your application, in addition to like you said, Avery, other preceptors, even if they're not in the same specialty, it's great to have a very personable letter from someone who can speak to your character. And so having a good diversity of letters, I think, is very important. And you don't need to like limit yourself to 3 or 4, which is usually the limit that programs have. Get more. And if you run into more faculty that you like and that might speak highly of yourself as a physician, go ahead and get those letters. You might be interested in the program that they went to for residency, and you can submit that letter there versus submitting another letter elsewhere. And so it just gives you more ammo to use. But for personal statements too, I'm interested in hearing, what did you guys put in your personal statement? We'll start with you, Avery.
I talked about, it's been a minute since I've read my personal statement. I really talked about it a lot, but I started off with a story of being in the NICU, and just I kind of started with the moment that I knew I really wanted to go into peds, and then I talked about serving as a missionary in Russia. And it was something, it's dumb looking back now, but I was always wondering, why did they always ask me about Russia every time, every interview? They're always like, what was Siberia like? Like, why are they saying this? And then I remembered and realized that that was a whole paragraph in my personal statement and a lesson that I had learned there. But I also talked about adaptive ski volunteer work that I do. And it's something that is just fun, and I love it, but that was a really fun one. On interviews, that it came up, I think, at every single interview that I had, that they wanted to know more about what it was and how it worked and how I got involved in that. And then I had one other paragraph, but I'm not remembering right now exactly what it was about.
But that's a good point, because the things that you put into your both CV and in your personal statement do come up during interviews. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I was surprised as well. You know, all the things that I mentioned, projects or experiences that I had, come up during an interview, because it was right there on the personal statement, and it gives them fodder to use during an interview when you're doing, like, you know, 8 interviews per day, it seemed like. So that's awesome. Was it pretty much the same for you, Bo? What did you put in your personal statement?
Yeah, so I kind of took that time to elaborate on my more influential experiences I had that I listed in my CV and kind of those things. Because you can put like 2 or 3 sentences about what you did, and it's like very formal writing of that in the CV. But so I did Camp Kesem, which is a camp for kids who are affected by a parent's cancer. So I did that all through like undergrad. And so that left a huge impact on me. And I thought I wanted to be a pediatrician at first. And so almost could have been a resident with Avery.
Yeah.
Which would have been fun. Yeah. I know, right? But as I just had, so I just kind of laid out how I came to that conclusion that I wanted to be a family medicine doctor in my personal statement. Everyone is just going to read and roll their eyes and be say, this is why I want to become a doctor or something. They already know that. They want to know why you're passionate about your specialty that you're choosing. And so I kind of laid out how my experience with kids and how I would love to be able to still treat kids, but I had experiences in work as well as on rotations that led me to really want to be able to treat adults as well, and even elderly people. I worked for a durable medical equipment company in the past, where I would visit these people, help set up some of the things they would have, even like hospice equipment. And so I kind of just laid out how I saw people's lives change from childhood all the way until preparing for death. And I feel like that kind of helps people get a good view of my perspective on family medicine. I want to be there from what they say is like the cradle to the grave.
Yeah.
Not to mean any disrespect or anything, but that's what it is.
Right.
And then I kind of laid out my interest in still being able to do procedure work and how I'm good with my hands. I'm a quick learner. I laid out some experience where I used to work in a factory for a little bit here in St. George, assembling some stuff. And I thought that was kind of a fun summer.
Sure.
A lot of stories came out of that. But
I
think just with kind of laying out why I came to that conclusion of who I want to be treating, what I want to be doing, and as well as what are some of my plans for the future, I kind of laid out some ideas that I want to be the town doc who gets out in the community and helps with some education as well. Have some free classes or free get-togethers to talk about common things like diabetes and just some nutrition, because I feel like you're not going to be able to get everyone into your practice as a family physician. But if you can reach the community, that's a great thing to do. And so I feel like hopefully by the end of all these edits, and you'll go through a ton of revisions, that I kind of put that across of who I was and what my plan was for after residency.
Awesome. That's really cool. And if I were to add anything to what you guys have said, it's very little. Some of the advice that was given to me, which might be, you know, specialty specific, but you know, putting why you want to go to a certain program too. I wrote out a general statement, you know, personal statement for many programs, and I picked, you know, my top 5 or 10, and I would modify one paragraph where I mentioned, you know, the kind of program that I was looking for had this, this, and this, and then I would modify it to say, I'm interested in your program, and I think it's a good fit because of this, this, and this. And, you know, I'd reached out to some of the residents, you know, the residents that are already there at the program, talked to them about the program before I made my personal statement. And then I would, you know, write, hey, I talked to this guy, this girl, they said this, you know, was here at this university or this program. I really want that in a program, and just show your interest. And so if you can, you know, word that into your personal statement too, that's one way you can go about it. But there are so many different ways you can do it. And as long as you can get yourself, and like Avery had said before, market yourself to make yourself look interesting and for them to pick that up and decide to interview you. So.
Oh, I would just say, as a DO applicant for family medicine, it was perfectly acceptable to just have COMLEX scores.
Okay.
And so if you feel like you're not super confident in your USMLE and you don't want to do it, or if you just want to save some cash and some peace of mind and not take step two, you're perfectly able to do that. If you're just looking at the programs that you are interested in, and you can kind of verify through different things like Residency Explorer or some of these other programs to see if they will only accept, if they will accept your application with only COMLEX scores. Mm-hmm. That's what I chose to do. I was able to save some peace of mind and some money on taking another board exam. And so there's just little things like that too. You don't have to submit your USMLE scores if you don't want to.
That's a good point. Avery, was it the same for you? Did you take step two as well as level two?
I did not. I only took COMLEX, and my COMLEX scores were not high. And I am not ranked highly in our class, but I got my top choice of program. I got my number one pick, and I think it really is just my only piece of advice as far as board scores go. Yes, do your best and try and get as high a score as possible, but not all is lost if those aren't really high. At the end of the day, I think they care about who's teachable, and I had a couple programs comment on how they really liked that my level one score jump, or my level two score, was significantly better than my level one score, just because the clinical stuff makes a lot more sense and is more applicable than the stuff you're being tested on for level one and step one. So there's hope.
There is, yes. I think that applies to a lot of different specialties as well. For pathology, board scores are definitely a piece of the whole puzzle. They do look at you holistically and want to hire someone that they find as a fit, not because they got a really good board score. Mm-hmm. And I took step two because a lot of pathology actually all of them are based out of, if they are based out of a teaching hospital, it's usually an MD hospital anyway. And so I felt like they were more familiar with step scores. And there are other specialties where it might be a little bit more competitive to get your application out of the pile. And therefore a good board score will help you do that. And so depending on your specialty, actually, regardless of your specialty, do well, like Avery said, try to do well on your board scores and do the best that you can. But if, like you said, if it ends up not being the case, you still are a good person. You got into med school, and so you still have something to offer, and you can still find a program that will see that, and you can get into a really good program that way. So thank you for adding that. That's awesome. So you submit your S application, and then you get to rank your programs, or at, no, before you get to rank your programs, you have to interview. And so you have to apply to different programs. How many, let me ask you this first. How many programs did you guys apply for? We'll start with Avery.
I, again, took a very shotgun approach. I had about 40 programs that I had figured would consider me given where my class rank was and my board scores and just location-wise where they were. The night before I submitted my application for everything, I panicked and added on 35 extra programs. And it's, I know I'm not the only one who did that. I may be the only
one.
It's
true. No.
I've heard stories. I heard lots of stories.
Yeah. People do that.
So I doubled the number of programs in a matter of 5 minutes, I think, and was just randomly going for it. And so it ended up being almost 80 programs where I applied, and some of those actually did come from the random ones that I think I had a total of 3 interview invites that were from that panic.
Yeah.
panic application one, but then I had 11 interview invite or 10 interview invites from the original ones. So I didn't need to shotgun it, but anxiety got the better of me, and I did.
And that is a very, very good point. We theoretically and hopefully we only do this once, right? So we only have one shot at doing, you know, applying for enough programs to statistically get into a residency and to get into one that we really want to go to. And so, yeah, the anxiety, if it is high enough at baseline, has been elevated by the time you submit your application and how many programs you want to go to, irregardless of the advice that we were given online by our counselors and stuff. I'll interject and say that our counselor told me to look at what the number that the MDs averaged out in my specialty and to double it. And so I ended up applying to 25 or 24. And I was talking to some, you know, fellow applicants out on the road. They had done half, you know, they had applied to 15 or 10 or something like that. And I bet they, you know, were fine and ended up getting enough interviews. And that's pathology. There are definitely specialties where you do apply to and interview at more spots than that. But Bo, how, let's turn it over to you. What about, what was it like for family medicine?
I mean, I kind of had a similar experience with look at what the MDs are doing. Then I think we were supposed to add on like 10 or so. I can't remember what it was exactly, but I just looked a lot at the NRMP charting outcomes document from the last year. And it just kind of tells you how everyone did. That's where you can find that information. But I ended up, I shotgunned approach to like Avery, just kind of spread myself all across the country, like Florida to Oregon in Washington. But I used Residency Explorer, and that helped me just type in my numbers for who I was as far as statistics. I mean, like my board scores and stuff. So I had a pretty good idea of where I had a pretty good chance. And so I applied to 35. And I found a pretty good number off of that Residency Explorer to kind of just add to my numbers as far as ones that I hadn't considered before and just added onto the ones that I originally really liked. And ended up getting like 25 invitations to interview. So then it was a lot of like dicing down, but I was just happy to have, you know, stuff to choose from. But
it's true. Yeah. There's that question. Is it worth applying to X amount of programs just to have that power of choice, you know? And if I were to talk to someone who is about to apply, you know, I feel like you take that number from Residency Explorer or whatever your counselors say, make that your minimum, you know, I'm going to apply to this many programs and try to find as many programs that you can envision yourself going to for sure. let's say you were to get your last out of all of those and you would, you know, pre-rank them, you'd get your last spot. Would you feel good about going there or would you be severely disappointed? Can you live at this place? Do you want to live in the middle of a city versus, you know, go out to a more rural location and start there and then add on programs as you see fit? And if you really see yourself going there, not only for location, but for other things as well. And so I think that kind of transitions into the next question, which was when you chose these places to interview at and ultimately ranked them as well, I feel like it's appropriate to talk about what criteria you used personally and in your specialty as well for ranking and deciding to go to these programs. What did you guys use to filter out all these programs and choose to interview there? We'll start with you, Bo.
So a lot of it was location for me. I mean, because it just kind of helps. You're going to be happy where you're living. And if you have, you know, family with you too, you want them to be happy too. And I didn't want to have my wife be miserable for the next 3 years or something like that, you know? but I looked a lot at that and kind of just what the program offered. So I wanted a full scope training experience, be able to kind of get trained in everything. Cause I didn't want to have that feeling coming out of residency where I missed opportunities to learn stuff. And so I'd rather be able to go broad at first and then focus in later on what I really want to do after I've kind of discovered that more, instead of having the opposite. And then it's kind of hard as far as just the choice to interview. I feel like the interview is just based on what you can learn on the website as well as the just location. But as you go there to interview and actually learn things, you'll pick up things that are red flags for you. I mean, one thing that was high on my list was just, what's the hospital like and what's the food situation like? Like, do you get free meals all the time or do you, what's your, on-call sleep situations like? Right. Is the on-call room, do they load it with snacks? And so it's just little things like this. It's like, because you'll get some that are so close to each other at the top of your list, and it literally comes to small things like that sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I made a spreadsheet. I tried to be very kind of objective about everything with numbers, and that didn't pan out for me at all. My personality was just like, okay, this is what I felt best about, and this is what I'm going for. And so my criteria went completely out the window. Probably not a very good person to talk to if you're trying to be very logical with some of that, like the numbers, statistics, and stuff. But for me, it overall, it just came down to my overall feeling of the program, what it was like to be there. Do I like the residents? Do they like me? Do I like the faculty? Yeah.
And I will say that I did the same thing. My wife was gone for a week at Disneyland. And so I just sat at home, like crunching numbers and inventing this like criteria rating system for my programs. And yeah, that was fun. You know, it kept me busy for, for a couple of days, but ultimately it came down to location. It came down to what the program offers, you know, in general, as far as the training that they provide. And pathology for me, it was fellowships. It was the laboratory experience and a little bit of research as well. And that was, and the vibe that I got from the residents there, you know, the people that I'd be working with. And so that those three were ultimately the biggest criteria that I used to rank programs. And before I went out on these interviews, it was kind of, like you said, you know, looking up on a website and just kind of getting a gauge. And I reached out to some of the chief residents and talked to them, just to kind of get a feel of what they were like, what their personality was like, and see if it was a location that I would be interested in more so than another place. But Avery, let's turn it over to you. What was your process like?
So mine was similar, very subjective, mostly, and I'll show you guys, I don't know if you can see here, I had a little emoji thing going the whole time.
Yeah.
So My first thing was if there was a positive warm fuzzy sign, if I was there and I got warm fuzzies and felt like this is a place that I liked and I was happy, then it didn't matter where it was, if it made sense or not, I put a heart next to it. And otherwise it got the, I don't know.
Yeah.
So mine was very, very subjective. on that, I did care about, I was not going to be close to where my parents live. Also, I'm coming at this from the perspective of someone who's single. So my decision, I'm sure, was more self-centered than yours, just because I can live anywhere. I'm sort of in this agile stage of life where I can move easily, and I'm not really concerned about if someone else is going to be happy there. I'm only concerned about if it's going to work for me. And so I did care somewhat about the location. Cost of living is something that was important to me, and something that, if really at the end of the day, mine was just kind of how did I feel about it. And as I was doing interviews, I was ranking them, and I was just asking myself, where would I be happier, at this program or this program? And so then I would just slip in, and I did change it a little bit over time as I thought about it, but honestly, I didn't change it much from when I was walking out of those interviews. So mine was really subjective. If someone wants to do something very objective and numerically based, there is something that an attending of mine suggested called a Pew decision matrix there. If you just look it up online, then you can sort of plug in what are your important factors, and you put in a numerical value, and it should in theory sort of chug out what works out there. I didn't think it worked for me, but I could see someone who's less touchy-feely maybe liking that version more.
Perfect. So everyone's different. Everyone's coming at this from a different background and life circumstance. And so whatever you use to rank your program with, I think you got to go with your gut feeling, bottom line. I think based on, you know, what the people are like, what your first impressions are basically like at the program as well. And I would say to having other people's perspectives as well helps. And this is where I would add in a plug for the various spreadsheets that people share on like a Google Doc or something. If you type it in Reddit, you'd find it for your specialty. I don't know if you guys used it for your own, but I did for mine, and people were sharing details and their experiences at different locations. And I would also use this too. They would post when certain dates and times of interviews were offered. And so I would use that to help plan my schedule beforehand, saying, okay, I'm really interested in this program. I'm waiting for an invite from them. I know that they probably will offer dates here and there. Let me try to keep those places open pending an invite from them. And I felt like that really helped the logistics of getting, you know, and planning your whole interview route at the end of the year. Any tips that you guys would have for those listening on the logistics of interview season, when it's coming to traveling, you know, saving money, things like that. Any advice that you guys would like to give?
For me, I tried to bunch stuff pretty close together. So if I was going on the interview trail, I tried to hit at least 3 or 4, maybe 5. You got to give yourself some time in between if you can, just so you don't get completely burnt out. But I would try to tack some on towards the end of some audition rotations. That's what I did for a couple of those, or plan it out to interview at another location that was in the same city during that maybe audition rotation. So it kind of just worked out. You just got to know yourself, know if you think you can be able to kind of do all that at once, or if you need to spread things out. But it definitely helped me save money and on flights and things, just to be able to kind of hit everything and in the same time. But
for sure. And I think if you have that advantage of knowing when that program is most likely to offer a date based on those spreadsheets, which helped me personally, that really helped me group some of those interviews and save some money there. Avery, any points of advice?
I think it's just important to acknowledge that it's expensive, that there's really no good way to do this super cheap, that there are ways to be smart about it. But at the end of the day, you're going to be spending a lot of money, and don't beat yourself up over that. One thing that's somewhat unrelated, I ended up doing one interview that was, or I did two interviews that were back to back. My flight got canceled, so I was going to miss an interview that I was actually more excited about than the first one. And I had a complete meltdown in O'Hare Airport over this, and super stressful. And I found myself asking, is it worth it to go? It was near the end of interview season, and there wasn't going to be another chance for me to just hop in later. And so if you find yourself in the position of you're not going to make it to your interview or you're going to be really late, I showed up 3 hours late to that interview, and I had been in contact with the program coordinator on that one, but the program director was so impressed that I walked off the plane into my Uber, into my individual interview, and was not flustered and did that, and that I cared enough to come, that she spent 15, 20 minutes alone, just me. She hadn't interviewed anyone, and she went over the program alone with me and wanted to get to know me better. So I think if there are travel logistics like that, it's okay to cry about them, but yeah, also it's rolling the punches that programs love seeing stuff like that. And I had, I think all of the people that interviewed me and then anyone in the office was just like, we've never seen someone do that before. Right. And I didn't go to that program. But if anything, it can work to your advantage sometimes.
For sure.
Being very professional, and if you're going to lose your crap, then do it not in front of the program. It'd be my only advice on that.
100%. I 100% agree.
Awesome.
It does happen, and it might happen to you, especially because interview season is during, you know, November, December, January, during those tough times of travel, but you make the most of it, and it ends up being just fine. With the last few minutes of this recording, what final pieces of advice would you give to DO students entering their fourth year, getting ready to apply to residencies? Let's do Avery and then Bo.
One piece of advice that a classmate who's a year ahead of us had, I don't know if you guys got this email from Trent, but something he had suggested at the end of third year was, if you don't have a weird hobby or something interesting about you, get one. Yeah. At the end of third year, beginning of fourth year, because I think programs really do care about someone being personable. Mm-hmm. And if you already have something, great, go with it. But for me, I joined the Utah Chocolate Society, and programs loved that. And then all I had to do was carry a chocolate bar in my bag, and people were like, this girl, this is the chocolate girl. This is great.
So, I had no idea that existed. That's awesome.
Exactly. No one knows. But it just, it makes it so easy to talk with people. And it, I think that was some of the best advice that I had received from someone else. And also just, I remember everyone saying fourth year's the best, you're going to love it, and it's so chill. And I was, by the time my fourth sub I came around, I was so burnt out, so tired, and so stressed. And I think it's okay if you're not feeling like fourth year is this perfect, glamorous situation that everyone had told me it was going to be. It's hard, but it is rewarding, and it's a lot of fun. You make friends on the interview trail, but if you're not loving fourth year, it's okay.
Good. Yeah. It can be tough, but awesome. Bo, you get the final word.
I'll just say ditto. No.
Okay.
No, that was very good advice. I'm just thinking along the same things. Fourth year can be bad, can be good, but you do have some control over your elective. So if there's something you really want to get into, really want to learn, take that time, just and have fun with it. A lot of preceptors are a little bit easier on you as a fourth year, I think, with some things, just as far as your schedule, because they know you're under time constraints. Maybe try to have a better rotation or a good relationship with the preceptor when you're receiving all these interview invites, because they'll come in waves and just suddenly come through on your phone for an email, and then you might have to start trying to schedule that immediately. And so that's just one piece of advice to kind of let your preceptors know in advance that you might have to step out of the room or take an email pretty quick. But I'd say, yeah, just take it one day at a time. Worry about the things you can't control, and don't worry as much about the things you can't. There's going to be so much that's kind of just really out of your control during this season. But I mean, just have fun with it. Have fun on your interviews and rotations. They just want to get to know you more, and you'll have a lot of success.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Bo and Avery, for being on the show, and congratulations once again on getting the specialties and residencies of your choice. And good luck to you both. And appreciate you guys listening to this podcast. And hopefully it was helpful for would be like as a DO student. And of course, there's a lot more information, a lot more advice and details that go into the process. And so I'll try to include all links and websites that were mentioned in this podcast in the show notes. And so you might have a shortcut there. But I guess my last piece of advice would be to reach out to as many people as possible who have gone through the same process as you. Just try to get, you know, paint that whole picture and figure out what is the best way for you to get to the residency of your choice. So I'll leave it at that. And if you would like to get into contact with any feedback or suggestions for the show for me, you can do so at theosteopod@gmail.com or at Twitter at @phil_osteopod. And with that, thank you for listening to the podcast, and we'll catch you on the next one.